Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today is Dr. Barbara Bellas, a Charleston native. She's now an independent historian after having taught for many years at Middlebury College. And she has continued her work and research in South Carolina history and come out with a fascinating new book entitled Two Charlestonians at War, The Civil War Odysseys of a Lowcountry Aristocrat and a Black Abolitionist. Barbara, welcome back to the Journal.
Thank you, Walter.
Your folks at LSU Press certainly gave you a subtitle that will attract attention, The Odysseys of a Lowcountry Aristocrat and a Black Abolitionist.
Well, finding a title was very complicated because we're talking about two very different men over the whole period of their lives and through the Charleston history, too. So this was the best we could come up with, but I hope it will stimulate interest.
Well, it certainly should, and we'll get into the book, but the whole background story, how this happened and how you went about your research, took me right down memory lane because it's the way history was meant to be done. Basic research, following the clues, sometimes literally walking the ground of your subject matter, and telling a story.
I think telling a story is the most important part of writing history in some way because you need to attract your reader's attention, connect them with human experience. And I must say, too, Walter, that it's through your training and the training at the History Department of the University of South Carolina that gave me this really strong foundation in going right to the primary sources to find my history. To be a historian, it also helps to be a little bit like Miss Marple or Hercule Poirot, if you want to. And I got interested in this because when I was writing a book on Josephine Pinckney, who was a South Carolina novelist and poet during the Charleston Renaissance period, and just in the course of some background, I read this memoir that was written by her father, Captain Thomas Pinckney. And he tells his story about his experiences during the Civil War and Reconstruction. Now, it's important to note that he writes this about 1900, which is the same year that there was a great Civil War Confederate veterans meeting in Charleston, South Carolina.
And that's when they built what was the old Charleston Museum.
Yes, a Thompson Auditorium. Charleston in 1900 still hadn't been able to repair the streets that had been ruined during the war. But somehow they found $30,000 to build this enormous auditorium for the Confederate Union. So while he's writing this, he's thinking about his past, seeing people he hadn't seen since he was a prisoner of war in several different camps. But also he's thinking about establishing the narrative of the war, the lost cause, what it was all about, and to tell their story, to shape the memory. And so in the course of this, I find it particularly interesting that in the course of writing about his experience at prisoner of war camp on Morris Island, he was captured at Hawes Shop in Virginia in May of 1864. And he was shunted around. He was treated terribly. He got malaria at Point Lookout, Maryland. He was sent to Fort Delaware, where he used to tell later about how eating rats was not really so bad, but the treatment was pretty dreadful. And then he was picked out, one of 600 men from Fort Delaware. They later called the Immortal 600. And they were shipped down to Morris Island. Morris Island, you remember, is the site of the tragic attack upon Battery Wagner, which was the topic of the movie Glory.
This is ironic. He's captured in Virginia. He's prisoner Delaware and Maryland, and then he's shipped back home to South Carolina. We did know that there were prisoner of war camps in South Carolina, but the one at Florence usually gets most of the attention. But there was obviously one at Morris Island.
Well, this was created in an especially insidious way, to use the Southern perspective, I suppose. The Union forces that was based on Morris Island had begun a siege of the city of Charleston, which lasted probably longer than any siege in American history until the siege of Stalingrad. What the Confederate leaders had not done was to remove the few federal prisoners who were still in Charleston, and they were subject to the fire from the Union guns on Morris Island. In retaliation, they said, they brought deliberately brought 600 Confederates to be put on the beach at Morris Island that would be directly in front of the Confederate fire from the soldiers on James Island. And so when Captain Pinckney first got there, you know, they were sitting, you know, under the stars, and they would see this huge, you know, battery of fire coming from their fellow countrymen. But to his great delight, what they had done was basically adjusted their guns and shot over them, and really never shot any of the men, but he said it was enormously frightening.
That in itself is a fascinating story, but in one of the irons of history, one of his guards is an African-American who grew up in Charleston.
Well, this is the part that caught my attention. He'd been there some time. He was very sick. They gave him a piece of fat, bacon, and a few beans every day, and he was wasting away. It was rather deliberate. And Sergeant Joseph Humphreys Barquett comes to his tent, and he had been talking to Pinckney's regular guard. His regular guard was a man named Sergeant Charles Lennox, who had been a barber in a town outside of Boston. And they had gotten along very well. Thomas Pinckney was a rice planter, and he and Lennox got to be good friends, and they found that they both were very much attracted to the novels of Walter Scott. So one day, Mr. Lennox talks to Sergeant Barquett, who was his friend, who's also a guard in another part of the camp, and tells him about this man named Pinckney. And Barquett, who was a native of Charleston, he was born in 1823. He left Charleston for the North in 1846. And he was very familiar with Charleston politics and the drama around Charleston as far as nullification went and the states' rights crisis. I think one way he understood about Charleston particularly was when he was a young boy in Charleston, he belonged to what was called a Negro band. And what he did was he would go and play all this rousing patriotic music for the governor when he went around the state reviewing the militia troops. So he got to hear all the various arguments that the Southerners were making for their position on Southern rights, for their interpretation of the Constitution. He understood the way they thought, though he understood the way they talked. And he came to believe himself, when he heard more and more about the Constitution, that he was a person who, too, could claim rights under the Constitution. After all, he heard them say, "We the people." And so as a young man, he paid close attention. He had a first-class education in Southern oratory, as we all know, was part of the grand tradition.
I need to just drop in.
Yeah.
He was a free person of color, which is an important part of the story.
Yes, he was a free man of color, and I'll explain a little more about this. Sergeant Barquett comes to Pinckney's tent. He's one of these 600 men, you know, in a tent, which is surrounded by a 12-foot picket fence. And he introduces himself, and he says, "I'm your fellow Charlestonian." Pinckney was taken aback by Barquett's interview with him, because what Barquett wanted to talk about was not the war. Barquett did not treat him as other black soldiers had treated him, with taunts as, you know, the bottom's on the top now. But Barquett wanted to talk about politics. Barquett knew the names of all the prominent politicians in Charleston. He knew all about the prominent state politicians, and he knew all the issues of the state politics in South Carolina. And Pinckney said, "I was so surprised." But this was the important part. Pinckney said when he introduced himself as Sergeant Barquett, he said, "I located him right away. I knew just who he was. I knew his family. I knew he came from a very respectable class of artisans and the mechanics of the city of Charleston." And this was so critical to Barquett, because you have to understand about the Massachusetts 54th, which was the regiment that he had joined in 1863. His leaders, Colonel Shaw and the other leaders of the Massachusetts 54th, were dedicated abolitionists. But they did not know black people as individuals. They thought of them as the oppressed masses. They looked upon the regiment of 1,000 men with black faces of different hues, but most of them, they assumed, had probably been slaves in their former life, and they treated them more or less as exotic. But Pinckney knew just who he was, so in Pinckney's company, Barquette could reclaim his identity as a free man of Charleston who had grown up as a man of relative privilege. He had enjoyed an excellent education. This is what first that began to really intrigue me about Barquette when I tracked him down. He was extremely educated. His writing was excellent. His references to history, his references to poetry. He had come from a background of a very small, tightly knit community of free black people that that Thomas Pinckney knew very well.
Now, see, I think, Barbara, I think that's a very fascinating part of the story is, given the size of Charleston in the 1840s, 45 to 50,000, about half black, half white, Thomas Pinckney immediately recognized Barquette and his family as part of the free black community, but they also went to the same church.
Well, that's true. The Barquette family, perhaps I should give you a little background on the Barquettes, because I think that this makes all the difference in the way that Joseph Barquette sees himself. Probably the most important thing that happened in those two men's life happened before they were born, and it was the Haitian Revolution of 1791. And it is from the Haitian Revolution and the experience of the violence and the bloodshed that comes about because of the emancipation of the slaves in 1793 that forms the background for the Charlestonians and other citizens, particularly imagining of what will happen if we have emancipation in Charleston. If we have emancipation in Charleston, Thomas Pinckney's grandfather said, he was General Thomas Pinckney, it would mean the extermination of all white people, of men, women, and children. It will mean race war. So this is in the background of their historical knowledge and in the people of Charleston. They're not only wanting to resist a change in a work system, they're concerned that it will mean race war and death to whites.
South Carolina in 1860 is basically 60% black, 40% white, and in the Lowcountry, it's an even higher percentage.
When the news of the Haitian Revolution came to Charleston, one of Thomas Pinckney's cousins, once removed, was Charles Pinckney, and he was the governor of the state. When he heard that 10,000 people had been killed, any number of plantations burned and destroyed, and all the property with it, he said, "We too sleep at the foot of Vesuvius." He knew that in Charleston and the outlying districts, for example, of the St. James Santee, where the Pinckney family had plantations, their ratio of black to white was 10 to 1. And this is the same ratio of black to white in the region of Haiti where the riot started. And it's this kind of historical memory that gets into the minds of the people of Charleston. Now, it's also interesting to note this. The revolution in Haiti is a very complicated affair that is involved with slaves, with free whites, with blacks. It's involved with the French Revolution. It's also involved with the imperial designs of Great Britain and France. So it's very complicated. Joseph Barquette's family live in Saint-Domingue at the time of the Haitian Revolution. I wish I knew a little more about them. I suspect that they came originally from France, that Joseph Barquette was a mixed-race man, and I think he had very light skin. His children were often referred to as being Brazilian, and his brothers and sisters, when they went to the north, passed as white. But according to the family legend, his father, Jean-Pierre Barquette, had a family of four sons. His father was in shipbuilding. They were not in agriculture. And when the revolution became dangerous for his family, the story is that he sent each four boys to a different port in America, and they had a little sign on their, you know, on them, you know, who they were for and who they would go find in that city who had been a refugee as well. So Jean-Pierre Barquet, I don't really know his history, but he arrived, he's established in Charleston by 1807. He is an umbrella maker, which is a typical French immigrant trade. And he sets up a shop first on Queen Street and then later on Meeting Street about the corner of Hallbeck Alley. And he becomes part not only of the refugee community, which is consists of people from that fled the French Revolution as well as the revolution in Saint-Domingue, but he also becomes friends with other free men of color, often who had European background, who formed a group called the Brown Friendly Society. And this was where the elite of Charleston, the free black elite of Charleston, or the free brown elite of Charleston, gathered together and formed their own tight-knit community within Charleston.
And, of course, the Charleston legend is the door was painted about the color of our old grocery sacks, and if you were darker than the color, you were not allowed in.
That seems to basically is the fact. I think that they would describe it as they wanted them to have European background. And they have been criticized at the time and even now for being exclusive, because what they had was a group of relatively privileged men who not only owned property through their professions, they were things like butchers and they were tailors. They were the working class of Charleston, if you will. In 1900, they asked one of the relatives of, when they were having a centennial, they asked one of the relatives of the founders, how do you explain the fact that you were so exclusive? And he said, this is the way it was. We did not allow black people. We did not allow slaves. But we also did not allow whites. So the way we thought of it is we closed the front door and we closed the back door, and we were able to discuss our own unique situation. They saw themselves as possibly creating maybe a new class. There was 1790 was the year it was founded. In 1790 is right after the French Revolution, right after the American Revolution. And it seemed like the whole world was in flux, that everything was going to be different and that nobody would be born into a station. And they often talked about how over time they hoped that they would become a third class. They would be what they considered like the Jews among the Gentiles, that they would be a different group. And they were very self-conscious about this. For example, they took great care to that their children would intermarry one with the other. So they thought of themselves as having a future. And this is the world into which Joseph Barquet was born. I mean, to be a free man of color, a child of color, you did have certain regulations, and his family taught him this. Frankly, the rules governing free people of color in Charleston were not all that different than the rules governing the free people of color in Saint-Domingue. So his father taught him how to navigate and also how to survive and excel, given what he had to deal with. I would suggest that what creates Joseph Barquet into a man who had the confidence in himself to leave Charleston and in search of his own equal rights in the American political system was he grew up in this community where he was known, and he grew up in a family where he was loved. He had a mother and a father, which was quite unique in the free black community because many of the free people of color had white fathers who really had very little to do with them. But Joseph had a father. He had a mother. They lived in a home that they owned. He had six brothers and sisters. They were 2 years apart. And he had this very solid background, and he knew who he was, and he knew who he wanted to be.
obviously Pinckney knew of the family, and the Brown elite did interact with Charleston's white elite, clearly on a business level, but they were known as a separate community. I mean, it wasn't just the Brown Fellowship, which was the most exclusive, but the entire free person of color community in Charleston was very extensive, and depending upon the individual, some of them had quite a bit of wealth.
That's true. The white community of Charleston had a complex view of the free people of color in Charleston. At one level, they were considered to be the intermediate class. They would be the class that was between the whites and the blacks. It's true, Walter, that not only did they have a significant amount of money, they bought property. This was one of the rights that they did have, or shall I say, they didn't have so much rights, but they were given privileges. There were certain privileges and limited privileges, one of which was to buy and own property. The other was to leave that property to their children. So they saw this as a positive thing, particularly because when free men of color or free women of color had sufficient funds, they often bought slaves themselves. Sometimes they were family members and treated as such, but sometimes they were not and treated more or less as chattels. So they saw this as a kind of buffer between the whites and the blacks. On the other hand, there is this other feeling about the free people of color who were literate. And the feeling is that they could read abolitionist literature. The whites were very much concerned about the kind of politics that were coming in with black sailors who were coming in the shipping trade. And also that literature from the abolitionists could come into Charleston, and they would read it, and they would start a kind of underground abolitionist movement. Charlestonians had been convinced that the Saint-Domingue Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, had been started by French abolitionists, and they were afraid always that, you know, they were working on Charleston as well, and the idea was to have a violent revolution there.
But the Denmark Vesey situation in the 1820s, he was a free person of color. He was literate. The first thing you see in the newspapers is a reference to Haiti.
The Denmark Vesey is the other aspect, the other element, historical element, that happened before they were born. The Vesey uprising or plot or suspected plot was 1822, and Joseph Barquette was born in 1823. So when he was born, Charlestonians were building up the fences, they were putting all those iron railings on top of their houses. They had gone into this defensive mode. And they passed a series of laws that made the slaves less free and the free people of color more restricted in what they were able to do. They changed the contour of the legal situation for free people of color. And at this point, a lot of them started thinking that as Charlestonians began considering whether they should stay in the Union, the free people of color who had the means started considering maybe they should be leaving Charleston as well. And so the Denmark Vesey crisis affects both Joseph Barquette and also Thomas Pinckney. The Pinckneys have in their mind that this is also a great possible danger. General Thomas Pinckney, who was in his dotage when this happened in 1822, he warned, he said, what we have to do is to get rid of all the free people of color. They're going to be a problem. They're going to cause a revolution. We should get rid of them, replace the working class with the Irish who were already started to come into Charleston, and we should take all the slaves out of the city, and we should put them in the plantation districts. Otherwise, we're going to be in a condition of great danger.
We need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Dr. Barbara Bellows about her latest book, Two Charlestonians at War. All right, the situation for free persons of color became more difficult, one of them being a law that said if you travel outside South Carolina, you can't come back. In Charleston, Barquette in 1846 leaves the city. But he leaves it in an interesting way. He doesn't just decide, I'm going to the North.
Well, the same year, 1846, that Barquette decides he must leave Charleston, Captain Thomas Pinckney leaves to go to the University of Virginia. So Joseph Barquette, who has been, as I said, a musician in the various militia bands, gets roused up with all the talk about the War of Mexico in 1846. And he has already figured out that the best path to citizenship for him might be to serve in the military, because he thinks that if he puts his life on the line for his state and for his nation, how can they refuse him citizenship? So when the Palmetto Regiment leaves Charleston in a great deal of, you know, excitement and glory, he goes with them. I believe he must go as a musician. But he goes down to Mexico. He comes back to Charleston 2 years later. Things have gotten worse, if anything, for free people of color. His mother has died. And so he decides to follow a well-worn path from Charleston to New York City, knowing he can never return. Some of his brothers have already gone before him. And so when he gets to New York, he has a bit of a base. In New York, though, something very interesting happens to him, is that he, for the first time, is exposed to a contingent of free black men who are militating for their own rights. In 1846, there was a bill before the New York legislature allowing black people to have the right to vote, and it failed. But that was just so exciting to him, and he went to talks on abolition. He read for the first time the paper written by Frederick Douglass, and he suddenly began to find that maybe this was his life work. It was a good thing that he had an alternative. He thought that he could become, you know, sponsored by one of the abolitionist groups, and like Frederick Douglass, and he could, you know, make his living this way. What he had found when he first got to New York was that his craft was that of a brick mason. But when he got to New York, because he was black, he was shut out of all the brick masonry work because it had been taken over by the Irish. He could not get a job doing even carrying a hod full of bricks. And so he found a little job as working in a confection shop. And then I believe at some point he got involved in the Underground Railroad, because he leaves New York about 1850, and he shows up in 1851 in Cincinnati. Cincinnati is the Mecca, the place of dreams for all the slaves who wish to run away and be free. It's the place where Polaris leads. It's the place where the drinking gourd points. It's the place where the slaves in Uncle Tom's Cabin, you know, make the run across the frozen river to get there. Ohio had, like other Western states, put bans on free people coming in, or they required very high deposits of money. He's in Cincinnati. He, I think, has come there bringing a young woman and a young girl with him. He leaves them there. They fall out of his story. But while he's in Cincinnati, it's the passage of the Fugitive Slave Law. And it's this law that essentially declares that any slave anywhere may be arrested and taken back by a federal marshal and returned to the state from which he escaped. It means that there is no safe place for any slave who runs away in America. It also means that no free person of color, no matter what his state, is exempt from the possibility of being arrested as a possible slave and losing all the right to habeas corpus, and he can be taken away. It's in cities like Cincinnati, you start having slave catchers running through the streets with hounds, you know, catching and running after freed slaves. Runaway slaves in the northern states were now in a state of terror. He leaves Cincinnati, and he goes to Wisconsin, to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and he starts organizing blacks in Milwaukee. Wisconsin has only been a state for a short period of time. They have only 100 blacks in the city of Milwaukee. But what he wants to do is to educate them upon the dangers in which they face.
These are free persons of color or runaway slaves?
These are more likely runaway slaves, although when you cross the Mason-Dixon line, when you cross from slavery to freedom, many escapees would take on a new identity, a new name. They would make up a new place of origin. I was interested that after Barquette leaves South Carolina, he never mentions the state again. When people ask him where he's from, he gives many people the impression that he's from Haiti. And he changes his spelling of his name to give it a French sound. So he wants to leave South Carolina behind. And he goes from Milwaukee to Chicago, where there is also a budding abolitionist sentiment among the free people there. The interesting thing about the Fugitive Slave Act is that it brings the escaped slaves and the free people of color in the North into solidarity with one another. They form liberty associations to protect one another. They give notice when slave catchers are on the streets, and it helps them form a bond together. Very quickly, Joseph Barquette becomes a leader. He is very eloquent. He gives these great speeches that sound a whole lot like Southern oratory, but also sound a lot like Southern black preachers, right? And he captures people's attention, and he gives them hope with the idea that there is a way that they can possibly form, you know, achieve the rights that they're hoping for.
And at one time, he's referred to in Northern newspapers as the Black Demosthenes.
He wins the reputation as the Black Demosthenes. And I think that the abolitionist group in Chicago, which is led by a man named John Jones, who was a dry cleaner and also was a friend of John Brown. And John Brown would come and stay with the Joneses just before he's getting ready to make a crossover with former slaves into Canada. And the Joneses had these long talks with John Brown, plans that would later evolve into his plans to attack the arsenal at Harper's Ferry. John Jones and Joseph Barquette were not interested in violent revolution. They thought they could work through the system. And the system that they were trying to attack in Illinois was a system of what they call black laws, which sounds very similar to the segregation laws that will later be imposed in South Carolina, but they were imposed first in the West and the Northern states. It limited, again, their freedom of action. For Joseph Barquette, this is part of the story that he told to Thomas Pinckney when they met on Morris Island, about how disappointed he had been in life in the North, how he was treated so badly. He was not able to practice his trade, his craft as a brick mason. His children were not able to go to school. He was a taxpayer, and he and John Jones and other abolitionists were trying to militate to change the black laws. This is what they wanted to do, was to work within the system. And Thomas Pinckney listens sympathetically. He makes a human connection with Joseph Barquette. And Joseph Barquette expresses to Pinckney how terribly sorry he is to find him in this awful situation. And he reaches, he says, I can help you find some food, even though Barquette would be in great trouble because of it. He said, I will bring you some fresh food. I can get you some fresh vegetables, because he could see that Pinckney was really very close to death at the time. And he said he had to go because his shift was over, and he reaches into his pack and reaches around. He says, here's a piece of shortcake. And Pinckney is deeply touched. And they left on this, you felt this human sympathy between them. Because I think you need to understand that in 1864, both of these men were awash in the undertow of the war. Barquette felt he was never going to get off of Morris Island. He'd been there for years. Most of what he did was hard labor. He never got to prove himself as a soldier. Pinckney was embarrassed because he did nothing that was very valiant in the war. He lost his grandfather's sword. He was hoping, expecting, that the Confederates across the water would come rescue him. They never did. And I found this a kind of allegory, if you will, of this connection between the white Southerner and the black Southerner between blacks and whites in Charleston, which, of course, has been fraught with all kinds of difficulties. But what those two men acknowledged, that they were both Charlestonians together, and that Charleston was a world that they had made, both blacks and whites had created together. After they leave, they never see each other again. But clearly, this had a big impact on Pinckney, because when he wrote his diary 40 years later, he said, "I was so impressed with his soldierly bearing." In contrast, he said, and using invidious terms, to those Yankees, you know. But what happens after the war? Pinckney goes home. He has fought in the Battle of Bentonville. There is no real home to go to. His family has left the Santee River Plantation where they lived. They had two plantations, Fairfield and El Dorado. And they had spent the war in a small farm, rundown farm in Abbeville County. So he went home to see his parents. His mother had died during the war. His father, who had been a great advocate first of nullification, then of secession, had urged his son to go fight, had assured everyone that South Carolina had a constitutional right to secede, that it would never come to war. He was a broken man. He waited until his son came home, and he wanted to live no more, and he died. Pinckney is faced with all the bad news he has heard about what's happening in the Santee. He has heard that the Santee has become just like Haiti, that the slaves are rioting, the slaves are taking over the plantations, they are threatening the owners. And what he has learned is that there are slaves living in El Dorado, and that his slaves at Fairfield have taken all of the furniture out of the house for their own uses, and they have taken up the land, and they've decided to divide it between themselves.
Thomas Pinckney's world was turned upside down. The family fortune's gone. What does he do for a living after the war?
Well, there was a chance that they might lose the land initially, but you know, part of the surrender was the guarantee that their land would not be confiscated. This understanding. So he decides that he has to go back and start farming again, because he said they would be absolutely penniless if they didn't do it. His sister says, "Please, you know, you'll be caught in this maelstrom." Cotesworth Pinckney, his father, had taken about 60 slaves with him to Abbeville, and they were still there. The first thing that Thomas Pinckney did when he came back from the war is he had to go to the fields, call all the workers together, and say, "You're free." He said, "Now listen, this happened right in the middle of a cotton crop." He said, "You're free to leave. You can walk down the road, never look back. But if you will help me get this crop in, I promise you can have half of it to share, and at the end of the day, I will make sure you get back down to the Santee." The Pinckney family had lived in the Santee for over 100 years. They were three and four generations of enslaved people. They had close-knit families down there, and they thought of the Santee as their home, too. And so they made the deal, and they had a good crop, and they went home singing and cheerful. Thomas Pinckney went home with a great shadow of fear hanging over him. So he has to get down to El Dorado, and he has to rely on a pretty good past relationship with the former enslaved people. And after a great deal of stress and calling in the federal troops, ironically, to help to explain to the formerly enslaved people that despite what the federal troops had told them, the land was not theirs. So after a lot of stress and threatened violence, Thomas Pinckney started his operation up. He managed to get a significant number to sign contracts. One of the problems he had was after the war was over, every day, former enslaved people who had lived on his land started marching up the road and expecting to be taken care of. So he had to feed himself, his family, and all the former slaves as well.
What about Joseph Arquette? What happened to him after the war?
After the war, he goes for a short period of time to try to keep the peace in Charleston. But what the Union general in charge realized that having the black troops was disruptive, not only with the Southerners, but also with the white troops. And so they were let out early. And he went back to Boston. There was another great parade. It was so different because in the Boston parade in which he left to go to South Carolina, there were people, Irish bullies, they would say, who were yelling and shouting insults at these black troops as they went. On the way home, it was a completely different story. These were men who knew who they were. They were fighters. They were warriors. They were artillerists. And there was complete, you know, admiration and applause for these men when they came home. They were victors. They were warriors. This is the sort of interesting part, the part where the things might have been a little different. They call them up in Boston, their former commanders, the governor. They all say, thank you very much and goodbye. And
the end.
This is the end. And there's no plan. I think we also have to understand that there's no plan for emancipation. There's no plan for how the Southern plantations were ever going to be productive again, what to do with all these people. There is no plan for the North. Joseph Barquette had a very good understanding of what was happening in Reconstruction in South Carolina. There were armies of teachers coming from the North to educate these people who never had an opportunity to go to school. By the time he left, a significant number of blacks were given, not only given the ballot, but they also had been voted into the state legislature. He was reading about this as he followed the path of South Carolina's Reconstruction. So he goes home to Illinois, back to Galesburg. It's a college town, Knox College, where there had been a strong abolitionist sentiment. This is one reason why he went there, and he'd been a leader of the black community. He goes home expecting all this great enthusiasm that had been for abolitionism to transfer into establishing black rights for the free people who, after all, had been made a major contribution to the victory. 100,000 black soldiers. He himself had recruited black soldiers to fight. So he gets home, and it's sort of muted praise. The feeling in Galesburg was, well, the war is over. We fought. The slaves are freed. Well, what more do you want? And also, the demographics of Galesburg had changed. And a lot of slaves who had self-emancipated had come from Missouri and settled around Galesburg. And they had a large black population. And so the enthusiasm for racial advancement had faded. There was also conflict with the immigrant groups. Again, he found he couldn't put his children in school. He couldn't vote. And so he started trying to organize the very small black population. They didn't get the vote in Illinois. There was resistance to the 14th Amendment that made them citizens, gave them citizens' rights. There was also some resistance in 1870 to the 15th Amendment. And Joseph Barquette, you know, wore his Civil War uniform around. He kept reminding the people in Galesburg of the role of the blacks and trying to translate this into black rights. There was resistance. And when he started to organize blacks for different local campaigns, for school district organizers and stuff, he started losing clientele. He'd gone back. He finally became, instead of a stonemason, he did wallpapering and painting. It's a story of great sadness. He is expecting that the Republican Party will reward him with some kind of job, as they rewarded the blacks in South Carolina, but he couldn't get any job. His family fell into disorder. And this is the worst. His wife had to leave Galesburg, and she went to Chicago, and she had to be a live-in maid, and she took their youngest child and their oldest child with her. One of his sons got into trouble, and he was sent to reform school. Joseph Barquette unhappily started drinking. It's important to note that the Republican Party failed the black people of the North so terribly. I mean, they didn't even give a position to Frederick Douglass until about the 1870s, and they made him the minister to Haiti. And they told him that, you know, you have to advocate Americans taking over control of the Haitian, you know, basically making Haiti a protectorate, which he never wanted to do. Joseph Barquette slipped into the darkness of alcoholism. He had to go live with his oldest son, who became a steward on a railroad, which was about the best you could hope for if you were an educated man in the North. And he died in 1880. One of the obituaries said that he was a man who had a great future. He was very talented, but he fell into the cup that inebriates. It was a story that happened to many soldiers in the North and the South. And he was buried in an unmarked grave, an unmarked pauper's grave in Iowa.
This story of two soldiers after the war, neither one really has a happy ending.
Neither one of them has a happy ending. Both of them are tragic. Thomas Pinckney had a happy ending insofar as he married a woman who was a tobacco heiress from Virginia. And so he never fell into that hard, grinding poverty that affected so many men of his class. And he became known as, he became sort of the symbol of the lost cause. Because one reason was he never had to compromise his good name. He never had to endorse insurance. And he never also fell into the racist politics. But his life was tragic because everything that he had believed in was challenged. Everything his family stood for had been destroyed. And he would walk on the Battery, you know, in his older days, and he would look out to Fort Moultrie and to Fort Sumter and to Morris Island.
I'm particularly curious about, we talked about pulling threads and finding clues. How did you track down Barquette after the war?
It was not easy. And there were many times I decided just to give up on this. I mean, how am I going to follow the tracks of a free black abolitionist who traveled all over the country? But there was something about this story that wouldn't let me let it go. And I tracked him down through, I read a lot of microfilm, you remember those. I found a little pamphlet on him that was written by a scholar in Galesburg connected to Knox College. It was a lot of footwork, but what the kind of the great breakthrough was, you know, late at night I'm on the internet and I managed to find a reference to one of his, would have been his great nephews. And he was a man living in Pearl River, New York. And he was a man who identified as white. And it took me 2 years to get up the nerve, and I called him. You know, I kind of gave him hints, and he was a Vietnam vet. He was a firefighter. I told him little bits, and so he was very interested. And I sent him some materials that finally I had to say, finally that said his relative was what they called at the time the Negro. And he calls me up late at night and says, "Well, madam, you have certainly changed my world." And I went to meet him. We had two great talks. He's now very proud of his relative who was in the Massachusetts 54th. And he looked in he said, "I'm going to take a look in my back room with my mother's things." His mother never mentioned that they had this African-American heritage, although she herself was quite dark. They just attributed to their French heritage. Joseph Barquette always identified himself as French. And I looked back there, and he found his Joseph Barquette's brother, Liston, who went to New York, and they found his journal that he kept. And so one thing, you know, led to another. I found one of Joseph Barquette's great-great-granddaughters, who was a graduate of Spelman. And so it was a wonderful trip for me. And we also have gathered together and got organized. Joseph Barquette, we've organized with the VA. And he's going to have his own tombstone, and we're hoping maybe to dedicate on Memorial Day. But yeah, he's come home too.
All right. Well, actually, that is kind of a sweet ending to a tragic tale.
It's bittersweet, but I think if Thomas Pinckney had not thought to mention in his reminiscences about this man, it all would have been lost. And so in some ways, he's returned the kindness that Joseph Barquette showed him, and that now Joseph Barquette has not been forgotten, and his relatives have been reunited with their past.
Well, Dr. Barbara Bellas, author of Two Charlestonians at War, The Civil War Odyssey of a Lowcountry Aristocrat and a Black Abolitionist, thanks so much for being with us today on The Journal. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. Dr. Bellas' book, Two Charlestonians at War, The Civil War Odyssey of a Lowcountry Aristocrat and a Black Abolitionist, a great title, but given the work that went into this, it could have been subtitled The Historian as Detective. From a small piece of information, Dr. Bellas developed a complete narrative of individuals during and after the American Civil War, and it all started with a chance meeting between Captain Thomas Pinckney and Sergeant Joseph Barquette, a Confederate in a prisoner of war camp, and one of his Union guards, but both of them native sons of Charleston. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.